Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Your next Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra embraces the dance, with a little creepy drama thrown in for good measure. And to tell us all about what you'll hear, our RPO Music Director, Ward Stair. Ward, welcome back.
Nice to see you.
Also joining us is St. Louis Concertmaster David Halen. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
And also a wonderful harpist, just one of the finest harpists that you will hear. Barbara Allen is in the studio today as well. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you.
It's so nice to have you all here. So let's talk about what we're about to see. We'll start off with the one piece of music that wasn't meant to be a ballet, and it's the one music you have ballet dancers dancing to, Dvorak's Slavonic Dances. How did you put that together, Ward, in your brain?
Well, we wanted to, I think when we initially were discussing the concept for this program, we knew we wanted to collaborate this week with Rochester City Ballet, and so David Palmer and I had a number of different conversations about various options, various repertoire, and I had just done some Dvorak, I think, and I mentioned the Slavonic dances, and he said, "Oh, I love those." And I said, "Really? Have you ever done choreography for them?" And he said, "Well," he said, I don't think I've done." He said, "No, it would be a great thing for us. I'd really love to do it if you just pick." I said, "How much time?" He said, "Oh, maybe 15 minutes." And I said, "That's perfect, actually, because you can get three really great dances with nice contrast in about 15 minutes, and that would be fantastic if you're interested." And he said, "Great, great." And so. So there it was, and we didn't. I didn't actually see what David did with the dances until this week, and it's wonderful. Just the way he captures the spirit of the three different dances that we're doing. It's great. Great way to kick off the evening.
They're going to be the dancers out on the apron.
Right. So we're going to have Marley down, you know, on the floor, and the orchestra's pushed back a little bit, and they're using probably the first, I don't know, 10 feet or something of the stage. So they will be closer to the audience than the orchestra, and right up front, you'll be able to see them very well.
And you had no problem with what you saw. I mean, what if you'd seen a dance that you weren't crazy about? Would you have been in that place to say, yeah, no, or would you just have let it slide?
Well, I mean, it's not...
Not that it would have been a problem with David Palmer,
because
it was not going to be a
problem. Of course, he's wonderful. But, you know, when you enter into a collaboration of any sort, you have to... respect other people's artistic visions, and if you want to collaborate, you know, everyone brings something to the table. The way they come together, I think most importantly, and I'm sure Barbara, you could tell us great stories about this, is about the tempo that is picked for the dancers. So they sent over some examples of things, I guess, recordings they had found, to ask me if they were close to the tempos I prefer. And I said close, but there, you know, the few things I like to do, so I'm hoping there's some wiggle room. And so when we put it all together this week, we'd go through it, and I did it just exactly as I wanted to, as if I were not, you know, trying to tweak it for the dancers, just to see. And then I would turn around and say, "Okay, how was it?" And they say, "Well, you know, this part, you know, a little bit slower maybe in the beginning, and then afterwards fine. And now that we know that you like to take it this speed, we can make this adjustment." And so it all came together rather quickly.
This is actually something that I have heard before with live performers and live dancers working together, that you're not in your head, Barbara, so you can step in on this one, that push and pull that has to happen between what you have to do when you're playing your instrument and what they have to do while they're doing their dancing.
That's right. And, you know, what I was discovering in rehearsal was that I am so used to the American Ballet tempos. Mm. On occasion, you know, we'll get another dancer in there who might be a little faster, a little slower. I'll hear from a conductor as they're walking in, "Oh, it's so-and-so tonight. It's going to move. Just be on your toes." But for the most part, I have tempo set in my head. And so when some of the pieces were started in rehearsal, I thought, "Oh, the dancers could never dance this." They would be looking at us, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's what 28 years with a company will do to you. I mean, it's just ingrained in me now. So
Sure.
It never occurred to me, Barbara, and I should say that you're the principal harpist with the American Ballet Theatre Orchestra. It never occurred to me that one dancer might be speedier than another dancer.
Well, they, you know, they've... we often get guest artists from other companies come in for maybe a week or so, or, you know, or for the season. Mm-hmm. And they may be used to doing something just a little bit faster, a pas de deux, for example. So that might move. Or I'm going to mutilate her name. Nina Ananyashvili, I think was her name, a Russian, who, whenever she was dancing, I would always, you know, get that little wink from the conductor saying, "This is gonna fly." the harp etude, whatever it would be. So,
mm-hmm. it's nice to be able to play music where normally you are very, as you said, bound to the choreography mm-hmm. and what the dancers need, and just be musical with it, because the Tchaikovsky is so beautiful in its own right. But it's funny too, from my perspective, with the dancers in the Dvorak being behind me, I can't, you know. When we do our opera, as you know, there everyone's behind me as well, which is kind of, it's not great, but at least I can still hear the singers. With the dancers, though, I can't see them, mm-hmm. and I'm far from what you would, you know, be able to call a ballet specialist as a conductor, but I've done ballet in the context of operas a lot, and I know that when we get to that point, I don't have to worry about balance anymore and breath control. I have to watch their feet, and I watch their legs, and I try to determine, you know, if I'm pushing them too far and they're really starting to struggle, or, you know, and I talk to them about it, but you look for different things, and a great ballet orchestra knows, just like you said, that there are certain things you have to do and you have to be ready for if a dancer is mm-hmm. has one mm-hmm. Strength or another, just like a great opera orchestra knows. Any singer, it's even more variable, I think, in the opera, because you know, they could be having a good night or a night where they don't feel great, and so you have to move something through a phrase. But you just learn how to listen to it, and it's fascinating, the difference in how you focus on different things, you know, whether it's a dance or sung or both or just music.
And that's interesting, too, because we had Lanchberry come in, who was, you know, he was the real deal. He was great. And so we were doing exactly the White Swan, and we were in the last section where the cello joins the harp and the violin. And he said, What is all this? What is all this? You're getting too loud, too loud. This should stay so quiet throughout. Mm. He said, there's, you know. And so he had his own ideas. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, so wouldn't you know, our main conductor happens to have studied with him. So it's always a little bit different, you know, who's ever conducting it, everybody's. And of course they are working with casts, so
right.
that will be consistent, one conductor to the next.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you can get a rear view mirror for these things. To sort of set it up there, you know, a selfie stick.
Well, I wish I could see it from the front, from the audience perspective, because I know it looks great. I did, you know, I know the Slavonic dances pretty well, so I did a lot of conducting where I was actually turned around and not facing the orchestra, just so I could see it from the rear perspective at least once, and it looks great.
Well, anybody who's able to both narrate and conduct The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra surely can do that.
You haven't forgotten about
that. I will never forget that.
He does it well. I've seen him do it too.
Yes. That's right.
That's right, because you've probably seen him do this.
I've a lot, actually. He got all of his practice while he was in St. Louis.
That's right.
So, David Halen, you're the concertmaster at St. Louis, and this is where you sort of really started stepping into a role as a conductor. So you have a good story for us. Talk about him as if he's not there.
Okay. All right. Well, the thing I've always felt with Ward is that he would never have a career if it weren't for us in St. Louis. And that we trained him, because when he showed up in diapers, it was just he was a vessel waiting to be filled with information. So I just told him at the end of every rehearsal all the things he needed to do differently. I'm kidding. He did great work from the very beginning. He wasn't an assistant. He was what we call the resident conductor, which is a position that really has a lot of podium time. He was on working probably almost every week. He rarely just sat in the hall and covered, but he was usually involved in a project, and oftentimes are really important concerts, like where we would have to play for a movie, or if we had to play for 10,000 or 20,000 people, he would be the conductor.
At Forest Park,
And for our most important patrons, as a matter of fact. And so he really connected with the community, I think, in a way, almost better than anybody else in the institution for a long time. Weren't you there for five years?
I was officially there for four, but then I
basically
was back as a guest a lot, and I'm still there last year.
It's coming back to do our New Year's Eve concert, which is one of our most important concerts of the year, because it's completely sold out, and there's always a lot of buzz with that. That's what the next project he's doing. But
and last year, we actually, this current arrangement of the violin solos was born in St. Louis last year, so we debuted it there.
This was a project where it was nice of you to give me the credit for the idea, but I thought we kind of came up with it together, that these are four ballet solos that rarely appear on a concert stage, in a symphonic concert stage, unless maybe once in a while the White Swan will appear, because it's part of the Swan Lake Suite that orchestras do. But these other solos, which are so beautiful and so incredibly well written for an orchestra and for the soloist, are almost never done publicly unless there are dancers on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
And so when this I was talking to one of my colleagues once, saying, you know, I wish that Tchaikovsky had written another concerto for the violin, because we play the one we have all the time. And I said, well, you know, there are these other pieces. And that was kind of the idea of creating this suite that's about the same length as the concerto, but it's all different material. And I was thinking today, as we listened to the orchestral interludes and the introduction to Swan Lake, is so powerful, and you played it so many times.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I have not heard that thing as a part of the orchestra that often in my life, and it's amazing. I mean, it's perfectly in Tchaikovsky's element to write these pieces, and then the harp writing is also
so beautiful.
It's so beautiful. And what you normally hear is the harp solo from Nutcracker once a year on the symphonic stage. You know, you'll hear that at Christmas time, and that's about it.
Mm.
These other solos are magnificent. And that's, to me, to put all this into one performance is a miracle, actually. So I'm really excited about it.
Has this happened before? Did you do this in St. Louis? Or
yes, we did.
We did it in a subscription concert about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and then I also did it with a couple of other smaller orchestras as we're sort of kind of trying to figure out what pieces, how to combine them. And actually, Ward is still, he's still making recommendations. We're still trying to figure out how
we're
to make it.
Still tweaking things here.
How can you add the harp cadenza from Sleeping Beauty?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's
okay,
the idea.
There we go. We
would you like that? Are your fingers bloody enough? Why not do all of them?
But Barbara, you were saying that there were some things that we put in that
that
you
the ABT has, of course, you know, how many hours of music is that Sleeping Beauty?
Hours.
It's
a lot.
The score is like a Bible.
It's huge. And it's not expected to be done in its entirety. It's meant to be used as needed. So the section that's so beautiful.
That entr'acte?
Yeah.
I just love
it.
I mean,
my God.
Isn't it gorgeous?
It's like discovering a Russian novel I've never read before, you
that's,
know?
Mm-hmm.
I heard this and I said, some new Tchaikovsky I haven't heard. I love it.
It's almost being premiered, because you'll never hear you don't hear it normally in productions either.
Yeah.
And we were looking for a segue for this Sleeping Beauty solo, which, because I come in C major, and you notice that one ends in like 20, maybe 50 measures of C.
Right.
Right. Matter of fact, I was thinking maybe I don't know, is it too long?
Tighten it up a little bit.
I don't know. But it's the
don't
way
touch
it arrives.
It's beautiful.
I think so too.
The
way it arrives in C is so incredible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was sitting there, and because you were conducting, and we did it three, four times this morning, and every time I wanted to hear it again.
Mm-hmm.
That's how.
Mm-hmm.
Captivating it is.
So have you never, David, have you never played anything but the suite? You've never played the ballet before?
I know. I've played all these solos at this point. I mean, you can't tell this over the air, but I have a lot of gray hair. And over the course of the last 25 years, I have played all these solos. And if I hadn't, I don't think I could do this, because as Barbara knows, they're challenging. They're not easy. And the harp part's not easy. The violin part is not easy. So, it would be daunting. something.
And someplace in the middle of that are the wind parts, and they are not easy either.
Yeah, but they get to count so many measures rest, okay?
Oh, boy, they sound beautiful, too.
They do.
Wow, they do.
Yeah.
Orchestra sounds.
I've heard the Rochester Philharmonic many times over the years because, well, first they used to record a lot with David Zinman, and I used to have those recordings. And this orchestra has never sounded better. It sounds magnificent in that theater. Oh, is it him? I just thought the musicians whipped him into shape the way we did.
Well, I'm sure. It depends who you
down.
Ask, right? No.
We'll discuss that with the microphones on.
Yeah, there you go.
Barbara, have you ever played with the RPO before?
No, I haven't.
Are you enjoying it?
I'm loving it. Yeah.
So you are. You can tell me what makes a good orchestra good.
What I have heard in the past, in a lot of festival orchestras, and if anyone's listening, don't think I'm talking about you, but but when you get a soloist and put them into a woodwind section in an orchestra, sometimes they don't blend and they are too much on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm hearing in the rehearsals is these beautiful, I said to some of the people in the section, I'm just hearing these gorgeous melodies, but they're all melding. And that could be because they're a family.
Mm-hmm.
It's so beautiful. I just heard the oboe and the flute. Everybody sounded beautiful.
Well, thank you. Now, we have a really great orchestra from top to bottom, actually, but the woodwind section, they're very interested in constantly perfecting the blend and
exactly.
the sound concept.
Yeah.
And you know, that's one of the most important things an orchestra can do.
Right.
And as music director, you know, you can encourage that. You sort of steer the ship, but they, at the end of the day, have to do it
mm-hmm.
themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, music director, the conductor is the only one on stage who doesn't make a sound, hopefully, you know, in a concert. So, it's really... Yeah, it's really rewarding and a fantastic and fascinating experience to sort of, you know, be steering the ship and watching it sort of everything grow and come together and develop and get better and better and better mm-hmm. as the years go on. So
you do become a family, and I realize when I'm playing with the woodwind section in my orchestra, I know exactly, you know, we know where we're going in the phrases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so rehearsed and.
Mm-hmm.
So
this, for both you and David, well, for all of you actually, could make guest performances a little tricky because you have to have a moment to try to figure out what the language is of the orchestra with which you're working, that language you don't know.
Oh, it's nuances, really.
Mm.
But it's lovely. It really is.
It is, and the interesting thing is that, you know, every orchestra has a similar set of issues because of the nature of the instruments and the nature of the placement. And for example, we have, which I love actually, we have Barbara sitting right in the middle of the stage, right next to the podium. So the harp is right where I can see her and I can interact with her sound. And I've done these solos before where the harp was 25 yards away from
mm-hmm.
me. and it's much harder in that context, but I'm used to it. So I can deal with it. I just know to expect that. And if I've got something that I have to align a downbeat where the brass section is going to come in, I know I have to listen to the back of the orchestra. They're really far away. It may take some time for the sound to get out front. So it's...
Yeah, and I think having you both so close to one another in the front of the stage is so great because you can really play soft because
and
you can hear each other so well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's,
and,
you know...
And yeah, not that we're ignoring you, but we're playing chamber music.
Well, no, you should ignore me in that moment. It's just you two.
But it's
was he there?
But that's what's supposed to.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
It is difficult when you add that distance.
Yeah. And then when our principal cello, Areem Kim, joins
beautiful.
Us, it's
yeah.
it's wonderful. I get to stand in this perfect. I'm right in the middle of the triangle of these three great artists. It's wonderful.
And she sounds beautiful. She's fairly new in the orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
She looks. Young, so
yeah. Well, she's been here a couple years now, but no, she's wonderful.
Another issue would be when your guest performing is the hall itself and trying to figure out what the hall sounds like.
And this is a really fine theater. I mean, this is a great acoustic. It's community's lucky to have this theater. And
they did a lot of work on this one.
And it has an amazing acoustic. It's visually just stunning. And to have this kind of space is, you can't buy it. I mean, you couldn't build something like that. That's why I always feel like these communities that build new halls, you know, they're taking a gamble no matter what. But even when they do, there's something about these old theaters where the sound has quality in it that you just can't get with the new hall.
Mm-hmm. It's almost as if every note has been absorbed and continues to somehow live and reverberate a little in
the wood is always vibrating, right?
Well, it's like violins. Yeah. You know, they say that Stradivarius probably, his violins probably didn't sound as good when he was alive as they do now.
What do you play for a violin?
Oh, I love to talk about my violin. it's a Johannes Guadagnini, and it's made in 1753. That's 3 years after Bach died. And it's before the United States became a country, but I always tell people, if I hadn't bought this violin, I don't think I would still be in music today, because it has meant so much to me.
How in the world did you find it?
Well, my stand partner, I was playing in the Houston Symphony, and the concertmaster, I was sitting next to the concertmaster, and he was the concertmaster in the Royal Covent Garden and London Symphony before he decided he wanted to move to the U.S., and make an actual living playing the violin, because before he had to work like a slave. And he bought it from Hill & Sons, which is an old violin dealership in London, and who had owned it for, I think, 100 years prior to that, and kept it in the safe. He told me one day, he said, you know what, I'm selling my violin tomorrow to a German investor who's flying here with cash in a briefcase. And I said, because I'd been hearing him play it for 2 or 3 years every time. Matter of fact, I heard him play this White Swan solo on this violin. And every time he would play, I thought, that's the violin I want. So I said, you know, Alan, what are they paying you for this violin? And he said, well, they're basically giving me, I'm not going to give you a dollar amount because it's outrageous, but I said, I'll give you $5,000 more if you sell it to me instead. But you're going to have to give me about a month to be able to find the money, because I have to borrow it. And he said, okay, you have a deal. And I didn't even play a note on it myself in advance. I didn't look at the papers. I mean, in a way, I was instinctive, but maybe it's foolish. But actually, it turned out to be a very good purchase. But also, it ignited my career. And the moment I bought that violin and I had it, I suddenly started being considered for positions like the St. Louis Symphony as concertmaster. So it really did. I mean, the tools are important. Your equipment does matter, right?
It's a partnership.
Yeah. I mean, you have to play it well, but if you don't have that instrument and you don't have that voice, it just, playing something like these pieces by Tchaikovsky, it just won't sound right.
What a wonderful gift for him to do for you. I mean, that's...
Yeah, he was. Well, he was my mentor, and he passed away about 5-6 years ago. But he always used to tell me that, he said, you know, David, you will be a concertmaster someday. And he always treated me with, you know, gave me advice constantly. And I'll never forget how helpful he was.
Can you feel the fingers of the predecessors?
I think that there's, you know, there is some kind of mystery that goes into these violins. And I was talking to my luthier. A luthier means a person that works on violins. And he was saying, you know, they... So all the repair work that's gone into these violins in some ways maybe makes them better too. The fact that they have actually been patched, and you know, if you took the top off my violin, you'd probably find about 50 or 60 little tiny wooden cleats that hold cracks together that have occurred over the years in this violin. And yet it's still better than anything you can make new. And who knows exactly why, unless there is this mystery.
Do harps run that old?
No. No, they there's quite a bit of tension on that board and on the neck, and then there's the mechanism. You know, there are 7-foot pedals, and from flat to natural to sharp. So there's a lot of mechanism that goes on with the harp. So they tend to break down over time. I have my one old workhorse in my living room that I practice on. I put the mileage on. And then this is my concert instrument that I have.
Is it better that it's a fresher instrument? I mean, is it newer? Does that mean more powerful?
They're all individual.
Yeah.
Totally individual. I mean, it took me a little while to get this instrument to where I wanted it, but I've used this for about 20 years now.
Hmm. But its lifespan is much longer than 20?
Well, after about 15, 20 years of solid use, which is what I do, the harps go back to the factory and get re-riveted, all of the mechanism. And then you get another certain amount of time, and that's hoping that the wood is, you know, it hasn't been banged up too much or, you know.
Because I know with concert pianos, you know, like, for example, we have two concert grands that we use at the symphony, and one that's magnificent, and it was made in 1993. Well, most people say, well, it's probably at the end of its life that, you know, it needs to be retired. But it went, and I remember, because I said, how long I've been there, I mean, I remember when we got it, and it was magnificent. I mean, and now it's not quite as powerful as it was.
You're right. They start out as thoroughbreds, right?
Yeah.
And you're ready to dig into them. But, you know, I still take my old instrument out as long as it's not, I wouldn't take it into the Met now, because I can't really reach the back of the hall without it sounding, you know, groaning a little.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
So this one is still okay. And I have another one in the ranks that's coming up. That's
and, of course, we're in the presence of a trombonist, and that's just plumbing.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically nothing more to it than that. Although we have the very important advantage in the brass, well, in trumpets and trombones, of price. We don't need to invest nearly what either one of you do in your instruments. But it is important to find the right one, the right fit and the right configuration. And, you know, it's a very personal, it's an extension of you.
Isn't the mouthpiece the thing for you?
It starts there. That's really important because that's where the sound is generated for any brass or woodwind player. I mean, that's where it starts. But there are other things, you know, that you can get into, the weight type of the metal, how many, you know, there's, I mean, people fuss with their instruments all the time and try different lead pipes and, you know, all sorts of things. But it's a lot easier to do that and, you know, keep bringing in a different instrument to try than it is to find another violin that, you know, is 300 years old and say, oh, well, let's try this one this week, you know.
Well, and then that doesn't even factor in the bow. The bow that we draw called. That's the other mystery is that, and bows have gone through the roof. I mean, a really great French bow made in the middle of the 19th century, the top echelon bows are now selling for close to $1 million.
For a bow?
Yeah.
I didn't
for
know bow. Bows were a million now.
Well, and it's because they're basically, what we have is we're taking pieces of equipment, but they're museum quality. And so, and that's, actually this is the problem with violins too, is that they really our price, the honest truth is that a great Italian violin like a Stradivarius, you may hear they're selling for millions of dollars, but the reality is that they're priceless. And we're just basically holding on to them for a period of time as they pass through the future.
And now you have an additional problem with bows because the older bows use ivory.
Yeah, well, we had a big scare where for a while there was an issue with the TSA and we were concerned about that. It seems like that's kind of gotten taken care of, but there's a little piece of white ivory at the tip of most bows, and we're gradually taking those off. But the problem when you do that is that it affects the balance of the bow. If you put a metal or a plastic there afterward, it doesn't have the same density as ivory.
And it affects the sound and the feel.
Yeah.
So there are two more pieces that we should probably wander over and talk about a little. One is La Valse, again. This was a ballet. I love this. The one description was, it's a disintegration of the waltz form, this piece by Ravel. Someone described it as that. How do you describe it, Ward?
I wouldn't go that far. I think it's more of a beautiful marriage between French sensibilities and Viennese sensibilities. Ravel wrote about his affection and fondness for the waltz as a form, as a dance, and he was enamored with it, as am I. I love waltzing. It's just, there's something really special about it. Once you get in that groove and then you become free enough that you can have a little rubato and pushing and pulling, but it's the music is very much, you know, it creates inertia just like whirling couples on a dance floor in a ballroom do, you know. And so once you get everyone on the same page and you get into this world, it's pretty tough to beat, just the feeling of it. It's freedom, but also within that 1-2-3 structure, and it's fantastic.
Do you yourself waltz?
Well, I've often thought it would be fun to actually study it a little bit, but no, I can't. I can't say that I can waltz.
The RPO should do a waltz gala.
That's a good idea.
A New Year's Eve waltz gala.
I would love it. But going back to Ravel, so he was always, you know, as I said, he wrote about how much he loved the waltz, but he definitely makes it his own. So you hear. You know, the waltz sort of starts in a very impressionistic way in the beginning. You can just barely discern the outline of the 1-2-3, the beat pattern. It starts very low in the basses, and then it just sort of wafts up in this wonderful mist. And out of this mist, you hear these, you know, these sort of floating clouds of sound in the upper strings. And out of that comes these little fragments of the main melody that will turn into this, you know, raucous scene. But they start very subtle in the woodwinds, and then the whole thing just grows. And as you feel it growing and churning and developing, you almost, as the listener, you get sucked into the scene, and you get sucked into the inertia that's created by it. And then Ravel talks even about how the whirling on the dance floor is uncontrollable, and you get drawn in, and then it whirls. The disintegration that some people talk about is when it just gets spinning so fast and it gets so intense that it basically spins itself out. It just gets kind of explodes, but it's very exciting.
Diaghilev initially wanted to turn this into a ballet and turned it down.
Mm.
And it was Ida Rubinstein. Rubinstein did it instead as a ballet, but this was actually created in Ravel's brain,
as a
ballet. So when you first heard this, could you sort of in your brain figure out what that was going to look like?
Boy, I don't know. Yeah, it I would say it evokes images, but at the same time, it's kind of its own animal. I mean, if it's done well, the orchestra really just, it comes alive in this really magical way. And so I think as a purely musical statement, it's more than enough.
When ballet is truly great music, it's like the music can stand on its own in a concert just as easily as if it does as dancers. That's always, I always think that's when you the Prokofiev ballets, for example, mm-hmm. stand up so well on a stage without, because you're going to visualize dance. But one thing I want to bring up with you, Ward, is that what I always wonder about with this piece is that it's written post World War I. And of course, what kind of political environment must have existed during the war and then after the war, there's a certain violence that happened in this piece, and you have to kind of wonder if that there wasn't some kind of either political sort of background in this piece or some kind of observation about the war.
I don't know that it was political, but I think what you're after is a nostalgia combined with a bitterness.
That's what I was listening in the house today, and I felt like it was like looking back on the naivete of Johann Strauss and then taking that into the present day. Mm-hmm. And as this piece goes on, you keep thinking, this is sort of like Vienna, and like we all like to think about with desserts, and then wait a minute, no, there's something dark in
desserts
this.
And waltzing, but then it sort of spun out of control.
Yeah,
and you
yeah.
have to think about Vienna's role, Austria's role.
Well,
in
yeah, that's
right.
what I'm thinking.
Right.
What and how the French must have been. You know, that was considered the enemy, and then he writes a piece about
About the Viennese waltz.
Right after the war. And I just, and you know, he, I don't think he ever said that he did that on purpose, but I just wondered if he did it subconsciously.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think there's a lot, definitely.
Barbara, have you ever witnessed this as a ballet?
I was just going to ask that. You took my question. If anybody knows,
I've never choreographed. I've never seen it.
I don't.
It's probably been done, but it's not done as the repertoire, right?
I mean, I want to propose this to ABT.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you imagine Ratmansky?
Oh, that would be cool.
I think it'd be fabulous.
I do too.
Oh, we have a project now.
There we go. Okay.
All right. I'm going to text
my conductors.
Exactly. We'll just make a note of that. Groundbreaking podcast. So the last piece of the music is The Miraculous Mandarin, which is also a ballet and caused a little problem.
Yeah, this is a tiny little piece. Not much to say about The Miraculous Mandarin, of course. It's... It's one of my two favorite pieces by Bartok, and Bartok is one of my favorite composers, so it ranks way up there for me personally. I just think it's an absolute masterpiece, and it's astounding the craftsmanship in the work. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And it caused, as you said, quite an uproar because of the subject matter, firstly. But the music also, people had trouble understanding it. And it, you know, a lot of people are aware that Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, you know, had the riot and all that. Well, Bartok's first performance of the Mandarin was met with even more riotous, you know, whistling, hissing, catcalls, everything. You know, they just were not having it. Then it was banned, and it didn't see the light of day again as a complete piece with choreography until after Bartok's death. So it was canceled multiple times after that. I mean, it was controversial for decades, in other words.
Which, first of all, must have been incredibly heartbreaking to him.
I'm sure it was. I mean, it's really, you take such a risk as an artist whenever you put anything out there, and to have it really not only received in such a manner, but then actually censored, you know, by the government. It's just, you know, it's like Shostakovich, what he went through, and other composers. I mean, unfortunately, it's happened throughout history.
Anybody banned by the Nazis, the whole Entente movement.
Exactly. It's, you know, but it happened to Bartok, too.
All right, subject matter. Give us a brief and as gory as possible synopsis. We want all the juicy bits.
I don't know. Well, if I'm going to really tell you what happens, we're going to have to make a disclaimer that, you know, parental discretion is advised, but basically, it comes from a story which was published, I think I want to say 1917, but I may be wrong about that. It was shortly before Bartok first started working on the music, and Bartok read the story and was just drawn to it for some reason. I mean, Bartok is he's a composer who likes to go to a dark place every now and then. We see that also in Bluebeard's Castle, which is my other favorite Bartok work, by the way. But the basic idea here is it's a fictional fantasy metropolis, a city. So you hear the hustle and bustle, all the frenetic energy, you know, going on in a big city in the opening. And then the scene kind of, the curtain goes up, and there's, you see three hobos or three tramps and a woman in a flat, a really dilapidated, shabby-looking place where thieves basically stash their loot and, you know, sleep with a roof over their head. And the first tramp is looking for money. He's searching through his pockets trying to find money. He's got no money. Second tramp runs around the room and is looking through all the drawers and sort of turning tables over looking for any last money. No money. Third tramp gets up off a bed that he's laying on and approaches the woman and says, you know, you have to go in the window and lure someone in so we can mug them and rob them. And she doesn't want to do it, but the three of them force her to go into the window. And then you get what is the first of three decoy games, is what they're called, or decoy dances, which is the clarinets are the main attraction there. I mean, they are the woman in the window. And the woman dances as provocatively as she can, pressured by the tramps. And so it's clearly a very unhealthy situation that she's in. And then she gets a first bite, I guess, so to speak, if you want to use a fishing analogy. And we hear the approach of this first person. We don't know who it is, what they're like. And this character walks in. He's called the Old Cavalier. And he's described as, you know, wearing kind of shabby clothing. He's obviously himself kind of a bum, or at least down on his luck. But he's got this attitude, this air of nobility, and he's kind of a goofball. He's probably a little drunk even. He's got a top hat that's clearly, you know, he probably got it out of a dumpster somewhere, but he's trying to make himself look like a gentleman. And actually, it's a very dark story, but this first scene with the Cavalier is as close as you get to comedy in this drama. And it is kind of funny because he comes in, makes all these big gestures, you know, of chivalry and all this, trying to be romantic. And you hear that in the glissandos and the trombones. They're kind of these goofy, cartoonish almost figures that you hear. And then the woman walks up to him, and keep in mind the tramps are hidden, so it's just the woman in the room now. And she says, okay. And the music abruptly stops and changes character, and she says, you got any money? And then he goes into this song, which is played by the English horn. He says, oh, who needs money? Love is the most important thing. So he's kind of like this hopeless romantic. And she's saying, yeah, come on, buddy, you know what this is. You know, love is great, but you got any money? And so he keeps trying to just woo her and be, you know, and she finally is not having it. The tramps jump out from where they've been hiding, and they form a sort of a line, and they throw him from one to the other, and then they boot him out the door. He falls down the stairs. And then it's obvious when that happens in the music. The orchestra really kind of erupts with this great burst of energy as he's jettisoned from the flat. And then they look and they see that his hat is still there, and they grab his hat and throw that too. And you hear it, the timpani sort of bouncing down the steps. Then she goes back to the window. Second decoy game. It's a little different. It's more extended. It's more complicated, and you know, obviously first try didn't work, so they're desperate. They need some money, so they're really pressuring her. So we go through another series of very provocative, very challenging passages for the clarinet. There are all these indications in the score where we have to speed up in some and slow down in some cases multiple times in a single bar. So the rubato is really intense. But it's all there for a reason, because this woman who's being forced to dance in this window is trying to be sexy and alluring, but is also terrified at the same time. So there's all this hesitation, and there's all this, you know, back and forth constantly. And it actually, if you do it in the right way, you create this atmosphere of tremendous tension, even though it's rather quiet, the music. So then we get another build of anticipation, and this time the build up to the entrance is a little bit more climactic, because the first, you know, try didn't go so well. So who's going to come in? And all of a sudden the solo oboe emerges, and it's a young student, totally different from the first person that was lured by this woman in the window. And the young student is kind of a blushing, you know, naive, warm-hearted, actually a good person who maybe just, you know, was curious, comes in there. And they start to interact, the woman, the tramps are hidden, remember. And through the course of their interactions, the music gets really sweet briefly, and it gets very romantic, even though there's always this dark undertow. There's always this danger lurking, because the tramps are hiding in the room. But the woman, her name is Mimi, by the way, she actually falls for this young student. He charms her, and they actually begin to express genuine affection for one another, and they come together, and there's actually a kiss in the drama. So a genuine, there's no talk of money and that. And then the tramps see this, and they're really mad, so they interrupt them, tear the two of them apart, throw the young student out. He's very upset. Mimi's upset. Mimi's crying, because she actually, you know, it doesn't take a long time, but she really had genuine feelings for him. And you can hear the student as he walks down the street still crying and wailing. Bartok puts these little wails, and they get further and further away. So now the tramps are kind of mad at Mimi. They say, you're not doing this right. Come on. You need to find us someone that we can rob. Get a better target. You know, dance better. It's really brutal, abusive. So she gets into the third decoy game, and the third decoy game is the most complex and the most emotionally sort of tense, for obvious reasons, because of what she's been through up to this point. So she engages in this dance, and then all of a sudden you hear the appearance of the Mandarin. And the Mandarin is a really stereotypical image. It's described as a man from China with a long braid in the back and a yellow coat, jewels all over, you know, clearly someone who has money approaching. And when the Mandarin first, when the theme starts, it's these descending thirds, be-dum, be-dum, it's way far away in the trombones. And you hear the fear, these waves of fear coming through over Mimi. It's just these really sharp outbursts, trills and fast diminuendos and fast glissandos for the strings. And the whole time you hear this very steady kind of looming nefarious or mysterious figure of the Mandarin approaching. Then all of a sudden, so this fear is building and building and building and building, and then the moment when the Mandarin comes through the door, all of a sudden the trombones and the brass are no longer soft and distant. They're right front and center, and there's this huge explosion of sound. The Mandarin comes into the room. Everyone's terrified. No one knows what to make of him. He doesn't say a word, and he's fixated on Mimi. He's staring at her, not even blinking. It's just really unnatural, and nobody, they're like, okay. And so the tramps kind of peek out and see what's going on. The Mandarin doesn't see them, and she says, and they say, come on, you know, dance, do your thing. So she sits down, and then the dance begins. And this is another section that is so, it's like the decoy games, because it's very delicate with the pushing and pulling. And again, her hesitation, there's this very strange character sitting in the middle of the room, not moving, being a total creep, really. But she's still got it. She's being pressured by these three tramps to try to seduce him so that they can, he'll be distracted enough that he can be mugged. So as she starts to dance, you hear this wonderful tension in Bartok's music. It's just, I mean, the way he was able to capture it is just mind-blowing. The dance, so there's, the dance builds and builds, and the Mandarin still, no reaction. He's just sitting there staring at her. And then finally, she comes over to his lap, I guess, and she collapses in his lap. After this really sexy dance, and he starts to shake and tremble because he's so excited, but he still hasn't said anything, and she feels really uncomfortable, so she leaps up from his lap, and he grabs her. There's a struggle. She tries to escape his grasp, and she's really terrified at this point, and then there's a really intense chase that happens. And for the concert version, Bartok chooses to end the music here. So at the end of the suite, it's the really climactic chase, and then, you know, very... very abrupt ending, actually, for the music. In the drama, as it goes on further, it ends up being the case that the tramps try, they come out, they intervene. It's clear that this guy is a danger, so they try to kill him, and they try to kill him four different ways in the drama. In the ballet, it's only three. They took one of them out. But in the original play, they smother him, they try to suffocate him, they stab him, they shoot him, and they hang him. And none of those things work. He's still alive. Every time he either gets shot or stabbed or hung, he gets up and goes for Mimi again. And then all of a sudden, they don't know what to do. The last thing they do is they hang him. He's up there suspended. The lamp hook that they hang him from breaks, falls to the ground, so it's dark. And the Mandarin's body is hanging up there, and it begins to glow. This eerie greenish blue from the eyes and from the belly. Nobody knows what to do. And this guy won't die. Whatever it is, it's some sort of supernatural creature. And then Mimi, after all she's been through, she has the clarity of mind to realize what the solution is, how you can actually kill him. And it's, you need to fulfill his desire. So she says, cut him down. And they say, no, no, no. She says, cut him down. They cut him down. He falls to the ground. Again, he lunges for her, and she doesn't resist. And once he's able to embrace her and his love is fulfilled, his desire is quenched, then all of a sudden all the wounds from the various ways that they tried to kill him begin to bleed, and he sort of just wilts. And that's how it ends. So he needed to have this desire fulfilled. It's very twisted. You can see how it had such a strong reaction when it was first premiered.
Fine family fare.
Oh, yeah, It's dark, but I have to say, the thing that I love about it is just the way the music is so... I mean, if you think about it, and I've spent, you know, a lot of time analyzing it and studying it, it's an atonal piece, but the tonality shifts. So you have these tonal centers, but he's always sort of chasing it around, but it doesn't sound to me like what you would, you know, the quintessential atonal music. It's not as thorny as some of that kind of music is. It somehow makes sense. And Bartok's inner ear and how he was able to get these relationships seem so perfect. And where there are moments like when the young student comes in, all of a sudden you get a warm G major chord that comes out of the low strings and the violas, and then it vanishes. But all these flavors and all these things that he puts into the music to help tell the story, it's just, that is the miraculous part of this piece.
So I ask you, I'm sure you've played this any number of times, David, is it as hard to play as it sounds?
You know, it's, I was appreciating sitting in the hall listening today, watching the orchestra grapple with this piece, because it's difficult, but it is so evocative. Once you actually speak the language of it, like Ward was saying, as I was sitting there listening, I didn't even think of it as being atonal.
Right, you don't. I know.
It felt like that. It's just storytelling, and it's so evocative. It's, you know, in today's world, what you would probably find a piece like this being written for a high budget movie, and somebody like Bartok would have been hired to, and it would be like a horror film,
just a slasher film, like
no,
a
but
real,
a psychological yeah. study, and it would be so it would make a movie so powerful. But the beautiful part about hearing a piece like this performed is that you can make that movie in your head, and your imagination, and you don't even realize you're doing it. It just takes you on this journey on its own, and as a listener, and that's what I love about concerts. And you don't need the visual part of it. You just it's natural. It just happens on its own.
Mm-hmm. The programming in general for this particular program strikes me as one that can offer you those pictures in your head with the music that's offered. It's all ballet, with the exception of the Dvorak. Yet it all has...
Which has a ballet element, because we have dancers, so...
It worked out pretty well.
It's many different ways to look at dance in all its splendor and glory and variety. I think it'll be a really wonderful evening.
Have you seen Miraculous Mandarin ever danced,
no,
Barbara?
No, I haven't.
No,
so
I've performed it.
But they've not done an ABT with
not
choreography.
Not in the last 30 years.
Wow.
I've never seen it danced either. I mean, I only really have... there have been recordings that I'm familiar with of the complete music, but it's almost every time you see it, it's in this concert version. So, I mean, I would love to see it danced. Mm. Love it.
I'll call my conductor.
Yeah, so that's number two. We got two good ideas here.
Two good ideas to take away today. I want to thank you all for coming in and spending time with us.
Always a pleasure.
Ward Stair. Thank you for being here. And, of course, David Halen,
thank you so much for being here.
And, Barbara, it's a real pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you.
If you'd like more information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.